My name is Sarah Goldenkranz-Solomon, and I am from an organization called Cardia, which is a nonprofit organization with offices in Seattle, Oakland, and Austin. And I wanted to talk to you today about some best practices in chlamydia and gonorrhea screening in a changing healthcare environment. And I wanted to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. David Fine, Jennifer Curtis, Wendy Nakatsukasa Ono, and Allison Atterbury. And I have no financial interest to disclose, fortunately or unfortunately. When I wrote this abstract, I don't know exactly what I was thinking, that I could cover five different innovations in a 15-minute talk. So this is not my usual style, but I'm going to try to go through this quite rapidly. But my real goal here is to point you to what are hopefully some useful links and resources and articles, either from the Infertility Prevention Project or compiled by the Infertility Prevention Project. All of these materials are available on the website. I've uploaded this presentation in a handout. I also have business cards. You can feel free to talk to me or email me afterwards. So the Infertility Prevention Project, for those who are unfamiliar, is a CDC-funded grant for free and reduced-cost chlamydia and gonorrhea screening for low-income women. And historically, for the last 20 years or so, there's been a regional infrastructure which provides coordination for meetings between different program partners and facilitates research, education, and best practices. So my organization, Cardia, has been the regional infrastructure for regions 6, 9, and 10, which is the West Coast and the Southwest. And now we're under a new grant, but we're still providing a lot of training and technical assistance. So why do we want to screen for chlamydia and gonorrhea? Well, these infections are almost always asymptomatic, but they can lead to negative health outcomes like pelvic inflammatory disease and ectopic pregnancy. And it's the most common STD chlamydia is, especially among young women. So annual chlamydia screening is recommended for all women under the age of 25 or 24, depending on who you ask. And then older women and men should be screened based on risk characteristics. And under healthcare reform, chlamydia screening has been rated as an essential public health, preventive health service. Excuse me. Despite these longstanding recommendations, screening is still pretty low among sexually active females who have come to reproductive health clinics. Only about 50% of them are getting screened. So a lot of efforts have been going on to try to improve chlamydia screening rates, focusing on identifying priority groups for screening and treatment, provider and patient education, updating clinical protocols and tools, promoting new technologies, and most recently, a real focus on increasing efficiency. How do we do more with less as our budgets are being cut? So the innovations that I want to try to cover today are screening adolescent women, self-collected specimens, expedited partner therapy, retesting, and pooling samples. If I don't get through all five of them, I'm going to be okay with that. So the first innovation is screening of adolescent women. It's widely recognized that overscreening of women over age 25 is a problem. But when we look at the resources available in most clinics, even if we were to reduce overscreening of older women, there really would not be enough testing resources out there to screen all women under age 25. And I'm not aware of any concrete resources available to program managers and decision makers on how to go about prioritizing resources that are available so that we can do the best job we can with the resources we have available to test women under 25. So this is from a study that we did last year using data from two regions and also the national IPP. And what we see is that chlamydia rates are much, much higher in the 15 to 19-year-old, the adolescent group, than even in the 20 to 24-year-old group. However, current adolescent screening coverage is only about 40% across the board. So there's a lot of room for improvement of screening in this very high-risk group. So what we proposed was allocating screening resources according to age, which parallels these risk factors. So we said, let's screen all adolescents and use whatever remaining tests are available to screen women 20 to 25, and then just do diagnostic testing of women over 26. And what we saw when we modeled that using the data from those clinics was we could increase our case detection by about 30% across the board without increasing resource levels at all. So that was a pretty interesting finding. This is just a summary of what I just said, but in terms of lessons learned, we really don't have any yet because this was just a modeling exercise, and as far as I know, it hasn't actually been implemented anywhere. So if you know anyone that might be interested, come talk to me. I'd be interested to know. I wanted to point you to a resource. We are just coming out with an interactive worksheet for test allocation decision making. It's an Excel-based tool that is pretty straightforward. It looks like this. You fill in some numbers in the gray boxes, which are pretty simple things, positivity, numbers of clients you've seen in the last year. And then it auto-computes based on the data that you put in for your clinic, agency, or state, whatever level you're working at, what your increase in test yield might be. Second innovation is self-collected specimens. So historically, chlamydia screening had to be done by cervical swab, which was usually associated with the annual exam when a pap smear was done. Now that pap smear recommendations have changed, particularly for that adolescent group, we're very fortunate that other methods exist, urine-based testing for males and vaginal swab-based testing for females. The advantages of self-obtained vaginal swabs, and that is when a client can obtain the swab herself in the restroom of your clinic. They have the highest sensitivity and specificity of all test types. Studies have shown that they are highly acceptable to women, and they can be done without a pelvic examination. So again, that's really important when we're not doing pap smears in these younger age groups. This was another study we did presented last summer. Washington State has been a leader in the nation in trying to advocate for the use of vaginal swabs, so these are just some of the activities they've done in the region. And what they showed was that over a fairly short period of time, they got 80% of their clinics in the state to start using vaginal swabs. And this graph here is just showing that vaginal swabs are growing in terms of the proportion of total chlamydia tests that are done. Don't worry too much about all the numbers on this slide. I know I'm going fast, but this is just showing that the vaginal swabs are being predominantly used among that adolescent age group and in school-based clinics. So this innovation and innovation one really go hand in hand. In terms of resources, we've got a couple of things on our website. There's a laminated patient instruction card that has, it looks actually like this, and has descriptions for patients of how to collect their sample, and it can be posted in the restroom of the clinic. And then we've also got a toolkit for clinicians on the when and how to do vaginal swabs. So in terms of lessons learned about vaginal swabs, chlamydia and gonorrhea screening protocols often need to be updated. A lot of our protocols in our clinics say we should screen women during their annual exam, and we're proposing that we update these to say screen them at their first visit of the year, regardless of what type of visit type it is, because a lot of the highest risk women are not coming in for annual exams. They're coming in for pregnancy tests or birth control pickups. So third innovation, retesting. So not only are chlamydial infections common, but repeat infections are even more common. And I'm not talking about someone who didn't clear the infection. I'm talking about someone who was treated, cleared the infection, and then got reinfected either by an untreated partner or a new partner. And we're worried about reinfection not only because it's common, but also because it's associated with an increased risk of complications. So that the PID, the unintended, ectopic pregnancies. So CDC recommends that women should be retested approximately 3 months after a positive test. If that's not possible, sometime whenever they come in within the next 12 months following treatment. A couple of studies that I wanted to highlight, one by my colleague Dr. Fine and I, and another by Holly Howard in California, which showed that retesting rates are really pretty abysmally low. They're somewhere between 25 and 30% of clients that are actually getting retested. And what both of these studies found is that this is not only due to patients not returning to the clinic after a positive test, but it's also due to providers missing opportunities to retest patients when they come back to the clinic for other reasons. So that was a really important finding. Some other studies have shown that providers seem to think that it's kind of a hopeless effort because patients just won't return to the clinic. There have also been studies showing that you can successfully increase patient return rates by using mail-in testing that they can take home with them and then mail back. The one last thing I wanted to mention about this is that when I'm talking about providers missing opportunities, I'm not just talking about individual clinicians who need to be educated. I'm talking about systems level changes, organizational level changes, putting in EHR prompts, changing protocols and priorities in the clinic. So the lesson learned about retesting from IPP is that quality improvement efforts should really target both client return rates and provider missed opportunities. A couple of resources. This webinar that was just done in July of this year, Evidence-Based Interventions for Increasing Gonorrhea Retesting Rates, was a really fantastic webinar that gave a much more detailed overview of the data than I just did, and also gives some really practical tools. And then the InTouch study is another project by Holly Howard that has some really great clinical practice guidelines and resources for patients and providers. How are we doing? All right, two more to go. Expedited partner therapy. So the most common reason for reinfection is having sex with an untreated sex partner. And a large portion of partners don't actually come in for treatment, even when the patient himself or herself was treated. So expedited partner therapy, or EPT, is when medications or a script are provided to the patient to take back to his or her partner without that partner having to come into the clinic. And it's now legal in 32 states and potentially allowable, or in other words, not explicitly forbidden, in 11 other states. So it's really gaining ground and widely recognized as important. However, of course, there are always implementation challenges. So this is a study, a very small study that we did last year, looking at three clinics in Texas that were pioneering the use of EPT. We interviewed a clinic manager and staff person about protocol development, staff training, provider practices, and successes and challenges. And then we compared their protocols and standing orders to what they said they were doing. And what we found was that implementation across the board was pretty smooth. Providers were in favor of the change. However, protocols and practice varied substantially, particularly with regard to when providers offered EPT to a patient, what criteria they used to make that decision. We also found that data was poorly collected and never reviewed, so a lot of opportunities to identify areas for program improvement were being missed. Skip that one. Also just wanted to mention there's a new response plan that came out about resistant gonorrhea, and this is important because it does have a little mention about EPT and how to deal with it in that context, trying to get patients to come into the clinic to get the injection form of the drug. And we pretty much talked about this. So a couple of resources for you. The CDC has a variety of resources on their website, some guidelines, a map of the states where EPT is legal, and a legal policy toolkit that you can adopt and implement for EPT. There's also a link to the gonorrhea-resistant guidelines. And then the Texas Department of State Health Services has some fact sheets for sex partners and for individuals just about chlamydia and about EPT, as well as a log to track the medications that you've given out. Last innovation is pooling samples. This has been around for quite a while but has not been adopted in a lot of places, and I just want to bring it up again because it is really, really efficient. So this is a laboratory-based intervention where samples are combined for processing. So instead of running 10 test tubes separately where one of them is positive, you can combine partial samples from five test tubes and run those together. And when you get a negative test result from five samples, you don't have to rerun any of those tests individually because they were all negative. If you get a positive test result, like on the right, you rerun them all and figure out which one was negative. So overall, it saves a lot of resources because you're only running seven test tubes instead of 10 total, and multiply that by a lot of tests, and that's a lot of cost savings. So this can be affected by positivity, pool size, and distribution of specimens within pools. So if your positivity in your population is really high, this is going to be less effective. This works better in low positivity areas, less than 9%. And then the maximum pool size recommended is 5, because if you put too many samples together in a vial, you're going to reduce your accuracy. So this was just a study showing that using 5 samples in a population with 4.5% positivity, the accuracy was really not compromised. Also, just lastly, wanted to mention that some work that the Idaho Public Health Lab did with their IPP project, where they have some great data on patient reasons for coming in and getting tested, and they found that those who were exposed to chlamydia or gonorrhea or had come in for retesting had much higher rates of infection, and so they pulled those out and ran those tests individually and pooled all of the rest of the tests together. And so they called this a stratified pool design rather than just a standard straight across the board pool design. And they found that this was actually an improvement over the standardized pooling. They were able to reduce their total number of tests even further. And they were quoted in their article saying it had little impact on personnel and resources, and it was an easy and advantageous strategy. So lessons learned, specimen pooling can be optimized based on positivity and where the positivity is concentrated in your population. A couple of resources for you, the Association for Public Health Laboratories, I've got their general website at the bottom, but they also had an expert consultation meeting in 2009 where they described a lot of recommended procedures for testing, including pooling. So I know that was a real whirlwind right there, but I just wanted to direct you to some free resources that are available both from my organization, Cardia, and also from CDC and some other places. So I would be happy, the presentation and the notes are uploaded to the APHA website. I'm also happy to share things by email, and I've got some cards up here and would be happy to talk to you afterwards. Thanks.